My name is Ashley, and I love the Unmistakable Creative Podcast because it's real, it's raw, and it's a conversation that matters.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. If you haven't visited the art store yet, be sure to check it out. Unmistakable Creative t-shirts are now available for sale, and you can see them at unmistakableart.com. They're available for both men and women, and they were designed by our special projects artist, Mars Dorian, so they look really cool. Also, I just realized the form for the Unmistakable Creative launch street team for my book wasn't working. It's fixed now, so if you're interested in helping with the book launch, visit unmistakablecreative.com/launch team. Now, let's get into the episode. I want to talk to you a little bit about this episode. Even though it's with a presidential candidate, I encourage you to listen to it with an open mind. I'd say it's more about the profound implications of artificial intelligence and the advances we're making in science and technology than it is about politics. I think you'll find a lot of what Zoltan has to say really interesting. Now, let's get to the show. Zoltan, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me here. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah, it is my pleasure. So I came across your story on an article on Business Insider that said you were running for president under the Transhumanist Party, and I was immediately intrigued by what you're up to, especially because you're actually the first politician that we've had the opportunity to interview. But what I was really interested in is telling a much more different side of your story. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, and how in the world that has led to you deciding to run for president?
Sure. Well, I've always been interested in science and technology since I was a student at college. And afterwards, I decided to take a really extensive sail trip, mostly alone, sailing across the seas and all that. But one of the things that happened on my 7-year sail trip was that I began working for the National Geographic Channel as a journalist. And one of my assignments was to go to Vietnam and film what they call bomb diggers, people that are digging up unexploded bombs that Americans dropped on during the Vietnam War. And they sell the metal, these bomb diggers. So a lot of people, instead of farming rice, they'll go and dig bombs. The problem is it's incredibly dangerous. In the demilitarized zone in Vietnam, there's a ton of landmines. And I was covering this story, and I had a very close call with almost stepping on a landmine. My guide pushed me out of the way, and it was sort of like a philosophical bomb went off in my head. And after that, I realized that I'd been doing a lot of dangerous things as a journalist and as an adventurer, but I was really interested in science and technology, mainly to improve the human body and specifically to overcome human death. And, if your audience doesn't know, transhumanism is the field of using science and technology to improve the human body, to improve the human being, and its main goal is to overcome death. So after this landmine incident in Vietnam, I decided to dedicate my life to transhumanism, which has, in a really weird, long way, led me to many different things as a futurist, including writing my novel, The Transhumanist Wager, which went on to do pretty well, and then also creating the Transhumanist Party and declaring myself a 2016 U.S. Presidential candidate.
Hmm. Let me ask you this. That's not a small goal. Like I was thinking about this as I was thinking about the fact that we were going to have a conversation, and it took me back to a memory of a friend that I went to junior high school with. And, he had another friend who was a Boy Scout who was one of the smartest kids in school. I was like, so what does he want to do when he grows up? It's like, he wants to be the president of the United States. And I went and looked him up on LinkedIn a few years ago just to see. I was like, oh, well, he looked like he was on the path. He went to Harvard for law school. I'm like, okay, but he still isn't a presidential candidate. What I'm curious about is when you look back over your life, especially early childhood, early influences, early mentors, are there moments of significance or inflection points that you think would lead up to you ultimately deciding to run for president?
I think everyone that I would say, I don't know this for a fact, but I would say that probably 70 or 80% of the candidates had wanted to do this for many, many years, probably decades, and probably, in fact, since their childhood or something like that. I was always told that, anyone can run for president, and, I sort of believed it. And to a certain extent, it's true. Anyone can run, as a presidential candidate. Of course, third-party candidates will virtually have no chance of winning, but that doesn't mean that they can't influence the entire camp, politics of the nation and stuff like that, because we're having a lot of interesting traction with how our news and the Transhumanist Party and stuff like that is getting out there. But I felt like, you know, since at least I've been in my teens, I thought about it. And as I was writing my novel, The Transhumanist Wager, I also thought about it because it's essentially a book about a philosopher politician who aims to change the world. And, you know, then I began really thinking about it 2-3 years ago. And I, you know, I think I'm married, I have 2 young kids. So the very first person I had to ask was my wife. Mm-hmm. And, because honestly, without your spouse supporting you, this is a no-go. You really need, it's a really much, very much a family, endeavor between the interviews and just everyone supporting this kind of, wild idea that, hey, I could, you know, lead the nation, down the path for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. That level of belief that comes with trying to accomplish such an audacious goal, do you think that, that's something that was inherently built into you because of the way that you were brought up or the way that you were raised or, you know, your background and circumstances? Or do you think that's something that can be learned and cultivated? If so, how?
Well, I think it's both. And in my case, it probably is both, but I can easily understand in other people's cases, it might've been one or the other. You know, if you're born into the Kennedy family, you obviously have a much higher chance of becoming a politician just because that is there. Whereas I came from a very kind of straightforward middle-class family. My parents were immigrants. They actually escaped communist Hungary in 1968, came over illegally. Well, they left Hungary illegally to Austria and then came over to America and became citizens and started their lives and you know, had me here in America. I was born in America. I think the main issue here is really like my parents were sort of part of a movement fighting sort of against communism. And so they had this freedom fighter mentality built into them. Mm-hmm. And they passed it on to me. And I think that's always made me somewhat of a revolutionary. And even now, even though I'm running, you know, for the presidency, I have some very radical ideas. For example, I have suggested that we openly rewrite the Constitution to adjust the U.S. Constitution to the transhumanist age, to an age where, you know, in 10, 20, 30 years, we may become more cyborg than we are humans. We may become more machines. We're going to potentially upload our consciousness into machines. I'm not sure the U.S. Constitution can actually handle that type of change in the individual entity that, you know, that human beings are. So I have some radical ideas and they have carried over, I believe, from my family. But at the same time, I'm pretty, hopefully, balanced enough to, you know, be someone who's could be a real contender for the job itself of, you know, being the president.
Hmm. Let me ask you this. You know, I come from an immigrant family and it's always interesting to talk to people who have grown up in immigrant families because I think that that influences and shapes the way we live our lives and the way we see the world in so many ways that I don't think people who haven't grown up in immigrant families really can understand or appreciate, at least at the level that we do. And I'm really curious how, you know, having parents who are immigrants, you know, and the Hungarian culture has influenced the way you live your life and the way you see the world.
Well, you know, I think it's totally influenced me in very, in so many ways. To begin with, you know, my mom is a Catholic and my father is essentially an atheist. So, and I went to Catholic school. So there's always been some conflict. And as you may know, or maybe your readers, your listeners don't, but I'm apparently the very first atheist presidential candidate, declared atheist, you know, one who writes about atheism quite often. So that definitely changes my platform a little bit too. And I think I got a lot of that from my father. You know, this idea that they also left Hungary kind of illegally and, you know, across the border in the middle of the night, that type of thing, it gives you this kind of fighting drive. And I think they've carried that through their whole life. My dad started a small business, was, you know, moderately successful, and but really did things his own way. And I feel like I've been trying to do things my own way and insisting that I do things my own way. I've really never joined the fold, even though I suppose now I am married, have kids and a mortgage and all that other stuff. It's been, you know, 20 years in the making before I actually really did anything that I would consider really normal, at least according to many Americans, you know, sailing around the world and, you know, doing war zone reporting for National Geographic. These are not very normal things. Mm-hmm. So I feel like they definitely gave me this sense. My parents definitely gave me this sense of drive to be at least to be somewhat radical.
Let me ask you this. That drive to be radical and have this individualism and sort of story that is very authentic and genuinely yours. How do you find that in your own life? Like, how do we as listeners and the people who are here find that in our own lives and our own work?
Well, you know, I think everyone, You know, to begin with, it kind of goes back to that question you asked: is this something that is developed through psychology as you're growing up, or is it something that's sort of built in? And it's very hard to know, and I think it's probably both for everyone. But I think for me, a lot of it may have. Well, it was definitely a combination, but I had always, you know, one of my platforms and part of my personality is just solid reason. I'm just, as an atheist, I just simply clamp down on reason all the time. 2 + 2 = 4, mathematics, everything has to be proven. The scientific method is my holy grail for the things that are important to me. I never deviate from science. I never deviate from logic. And or at least I try not to. I do not like to let emotions be a part of my decision-making process because I think it leads to, dangerous things. So when you ask me kind of this question of like, you know, what makes a person or how do we get there, I'd like to deduce it with logic and say, well, I wanted to do this, or I was very interested after the Vietnam incident of not dying, and you know, and so I want to dedicate my life to transhumanism, you know, dedicate my life to science and technology, and that's why I went down that path. Now, I, of course, have just logically deduced that for you, but perhaps there's a lot more inherent DNA and genetic influence that I'm not giving credit for. But I think everyone can deduce, use logic to find out exactly what they want to do, what they're best at, and what really the most meaning in their life that they can find. And I encourage everyone to philosophically reason with themselves and find that path rather than just saying, oh, I feel this way. Because I think in the end of the day, understanding something in a logical way is the thing that makes it stick.
Mm. Okay, so that actually brings up a question for me. You mentioned that you don't let emotions get involved in your decision-making process. And it's going to be really interesting to hear what you have to say about this. I mean, emotions to me are largely what makes us human, but I agree with the fact that when we make decisions from an extreme emotional place, we tend to make irrational decisions. And I'm really interested in learning how we manage our own psychology and how we cultivate this capacity not to make decisions from an emotional place.
Well, yeah. And, you know, when I say I don't make decisions from an emotional level, what I'm really saying is I'm trying not to make, decisions from an emotional level. Because, of course, we are emotional beings. And with all our emotions stripped away, I'm not sure what we would be. A lot of neurologists and a lot of, neuroscientists believe that without emotions, our brains might not even operate this, in the same type of reality we have, which is probably right. Mm. So it's very difficult to separate the two. I think what I'm trying to say is one has to have an emotional impulse when making a decision. But at the end of the day, the prism that it has to go through is reason and logic. And it's great to be creative because I write articles all the time. I write novels. I play piano and guitar. And creativity comes from a very emotional place, and that's wonderful. But in the end of the day, we need to be very careful that our big decisions in life go through a kind of a prism of reason where we can say, okay, even though this feels good, is this really going to be good for the long-term effect? And not just, 1 year or 1 month, but 10 years, 20 years, and for my family and for the world, for the environment. There are all these different things. So I try to be very emotional, to be honest with you. I enjoy it, embrace it. But at the same time, I want to make sure that at every step where my emotion is starting to really dictate policy, that's when I step back and say, okay, now, filter it through reason and make sure it's good. And if it doesn't, then I have a conflict between my emotion and my reason, which happens a lot, which happens with all people. Mm-hmm. But hopefully my reason does work because I feel like irrational decision-making is what leads to, some of the tragedies of life, families breaking up or, just friendships ending or making bad career decisions. So we have to be very careful not to let our emotions dictate the overall goals, and which is one of the reasons why I really stomp down on reason and logic as a method, as the kind of final tool and the final arbiter of all my decisions.
Hmm. One of the other things you brought up was atheism. And it's funny, the reason this is hot on my mind is because we had, I think, 3 guests in a row who were all Christians. And somebody asked me a few days ago, Srini, is that coincidental or are you exploring some sort of new religious or spiritual path? I said, no, that was entirely coincidental. This is something that I'm deeply curious about. You having spent all this time sailing around the world, but you're an atheist. I mean, does spirituality and that kind of thing play a role in your life? And if so, how?
So, this is very interesting. In my novel, The Transhumanist Wager, there's a character, one of the central ones, and her name's Zoe Bach, and she is sort of a spiritual transhumanist or someone who believes in using technology for gaining greater access to spirituality. And while I like that perspective, and in fact, the main character marries that person, I'm still a little bit skeptical of spirituality at all. That said, I have been recently, for one of my national columns, which is with Vice Motherboard, have been writing a lot on artificial intelligence and on incredibly bizarre concepts. I'm the one who came up with this theocidism, which essentially is, you probably haven't heard it, but it's very new, this idea that God may have once existed, but he or she killed itself. And as a result, by doing so, by killing itself, it created a universe where it would have instilled free will. One of the problems with having an all-knowing God, for example, in a universe is that it knows everything. That means everything is to some extent already determined, and nobody wants to live in a universe that is totally determined. So if there was a God, the right thing would be to kill itself. And I'm a pretty big believer that we're not the only species in the universe. The universe has been around 14 billion years, and to think that human beings are the only intelligent life form in the universe when there are 2 billion other planets out there that are probably habitable is absurd. It's completely irrational. So we're almost certainly not the most intelligent species on the planet, which means there's other species that have probably discovered artificial intelligence, probably super intelligences, probably exist way out there. We might even be in a hologram of a universe. In fact, I did a lot of my senior thesis at Columbia University on this holographic universe, which is we are just projections of some other type of entity or some type of manifestation of some sort. But the point of the story is that this idea I came up with, theocidism, where there may have been a super intelligence like God, but it eliminated itself in order to insist that there can never ever be a universe where we don't have perfect free will. By one of the main concepts of the theocidism is that by this God killing itself, it would have established that no superintelligence could ever change the rules of the universe, meaning that no superintelligence could ever actually become an omnipotent being. And this works in really well for a lot of different religious aspects. But the more important part of it, and I know I'm getting a little spacey here, but the more important part of this is that it kind of works into spirituality. How far, when we talk about spirituality, do we talk about other intelligences that have existed for millions of years somewhere else? Or are we just talking about what's in our own head? Or are we talking about a God we created 2,000 years ago in the desert that was crucified? I mean, these are things. When I say I'm an atheist, I mean I stand for a program or a culture that has no definitive formal belief in an omnipotent God, because I just don't like it. And also, you know, fundamentally, religion has caused many problems through the last few centuries. So I think the human race would be better off to just either be spiritual or to believe in something like theocidism, or just to just be sort of like I am, which is, hey, I'm an atheist, but I'm not really sure if I know anything. But I'm going to try to use, use logic and reason to make the world a better place and be good to people. Mm.
So let me ask you this. We've talked a little bit about atheism, and you know, I was thinking about our dollar bills, right? On the dollar bill, it says "In God We Trust," and I'm curious, when you're talking about this from a political perspective, how you resolve that tension between an entire country that is largely driven by some level of faith in God, and nearly every presidential candidate has had some level of faith. I'm just interested in how that plays out in the messaging and how that plays out in the way you craft the story that you're trying to tell the world.
Oh, and it so does. And, just your listeners know, of course, it's not just the dollar bill. It's to get the office, you have to swear on the Bible.
Yeah.
Obama swore. I mean, all these people. And it's when someone sneezes, we say, God bless you. It's the saying, the Pledge of Allegiance. There's all these different things. At Christmas time, the most important holiday, I have suggested that when humans give birth to artificial intelligence, the new most important holiday might be actually a day dedicated to artificial intelligence, because likely artificial intelligence will change the world one way or the other so dramatically. But the point here is that I try to, in my politics, tell people that we can be good without God, that we can thrive without God. God worked really well. I think as we were developing as a species, it was important to have some type of rules set in place and worried about an afterlife and this and that. But, the main thing with transhumanists is we don't need an afterlife anymore, because we have the science and technology to stop aging or to create a kind of indefinite lifespan for ourselves, either through robotics or bionics or mind uploading. And most experts think within 10 to 20 years, we're going to come very close to stopping aging, which means most humans, at least humans born today, I have no doubt that any human born today will live indefinitely, so long as there's no apocalyptic an asteroid hitting the planet or some type of environmental collapse. In fact, I'm 42 and I'm pretty sure I have an incredibly solid chance of living indefinitely just based on how fast science and technology is moving. I mean, they're already reversing aging in mice in studies. So we have a good chance of doing it. But this changes the picture of why we need religion and why we need religion, especially in politics. At the same time, it's incredibly sad that there are virtually no atheist politicians right now in the United States government. You have 7 Supreme Court leaders, you have the president, and you have 535 Congress members. Not one of them is a declared atheist. Think of that. We have an entire nation. You have, over 600 people that run the country that all apparently believe in a formal religion. That is something that is wrong. It's not diversity. That's not what America is based on. So I try to tell people this as I run as an atheist politician. I try to say, we can do this without having to use the handicap of God. We can do the same good things to people, the same humanitarian things, without actually having to belong to some kind of formal religion. And I think that's very important because it's a step of evolutionary kind of growing up or just kind of maturity to say, hey, we can be a very good humanitarian race without without the need to worry about, burning forever in hell or, praying to something that has all power over us. We don't need those things anymore. Mm.
Okay, so that raises a question for me. You know, one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about on the show and with a lot of our guests is this whole notion of living a meaningful life, because it's one life that we're given and we don't know when it's going to end. And when you propose the idea that our lifespan could be indefinite, how does that change in your mind what it means to live a meaningful life and what we value?
Great question, because, and this is one of the most important questions I get asked, both in my presidential campaign and as kind of a pretty visible transhumanist, is that, wow, if we live forever, it just changes the scope of meaning. It changes the entire sense of meaning. One of the most important things I try to tell people is that don't imagine the rest of infinity as you're imagining it right now, because that's a big mistake. We are not going to be the same things that we are 30 years ago. And I don't mean we're going to be a little bit older with more memories. I mean, we're going to have augmented intelligence. We're going to have robotic bodies. We're going to be living inside machines. We're going to have robotic hearts that enable us to hold our breath for, 20 minutes in a row, or enable us to run faster than cheetahs, bionic limbs. Or we're going to, just have exoskeleton suits that allow us to do all sorts of things, endoskeleton suits, suits that are actually attached to our skeletal structure. So you have to understand the reality of the human being is going to be severely different. But more importantly, the reality of the human mind is going to be different. We have 5 basic senses right now, but there's going to be a lot more senses by the time the transhumanist age is over. Within 20 years, I think they're going to electively already have bionic eyes, for example. And I just did a story for Gizmodo on bionic eyes. Mm. Already, if you don't know and your listeners don't know, they have the Argus 2, which allows blind people to see. It's something that taps into your eyeball, taps into your optic nerve. It's a computer chip, and it's just a telephoto lens. So there are some blind people out there that actually have better zoom and vision than any human being on the planet. They're already transhuman. But the point of this is every single aspect of our body and our mind is going to be changed. As soon as we start putting chip implants into our head, and about 500,000 people around the world right now have brain implants already. Most of them are for epilepsy or Alzheimer's or because they're deaf. But the point is that we already have brain implants. We're going to be using it in the near future, within 10 to 20 years, to augment our intelligence. It's going to give us the capacity that we've never imagined. We're going to be 1,000 times smarter than Einstein within 50 years. We're going to tap ourselves into all the internet bases. It's going to be like the Matrix. And when people think of, wow, the world's going to be boring to live infinitely, it's because they're trying to see it from the point of view they have now, which is, we're a biological animal that's destined to last, live 70 or 80 years. It's not going to be like that. When we're tapped into artificial intelligence and our IQ or our capacity is 1,000,000 times more what it is, we're going to find different value systems. And that's the key I try to tell people. The transhumanist age will create different value systems because of technology. We'll have a different way of perceiving what is meaning, how long we want to live. Maybe a million-year lifespan will seem very short to a transhuman being once he's been plugged in and, you know, his mind can travel the internet and be a part of that. So I always encourage people to not look at it from the human perspective, but try to imagine the transhumanist perspective. Then they'll find a lot more meaning, a lot more discovery out there in a universe that we can literally traverse. And we're going to have so many more senses to play with, so many more versions of reality, so many more things to do that I don't think we're ever going to get bored.
Hmm. Okay, so this opens up a whole landmine of questions for me. Really fascinating stuff. One of the things that's interesting, as I'm hearing you say that, the thing I think about is how much time we spend talking about disconnecting and unplugging from technology to maintain our sort of sanity. And I'm wondering how that plays into all of this.
Well, yeah, and I think everyone, including myself, sometimes is pretty upset with technology or just feels overwhelmed. Let's be honest, the human mind was not designed to drive in cars at 45 miles per hour down the road 2 hours a day in traffic or drinking coffee and listening to the radio. That's not what our brains were designed for. Our brains were designed to, walk amongst the trees, walk down and climb trees and eat fruit, whatever. What's happened is technology has evolved far faster than our brains or than our biological necessities have. And this kind of has created a disconnect. So when you live in a concrete environment or you live in a big city or you just, you're away from nature, you feel that disconnect. And then you get overwhelmed because we were never designed to work 40-hour weeks and some of us, like myself, working 100-hour weeks. This is not what the human being was designed to do. We were lazy creatures that wanted to hunt and gather and essentially, mate and hang out with our kids and, have a good time. This is kind of what our bodies, our brains were designed for. So we're constantly facing this disconnect. That said, obviously, I think most people realize from a rational perspective, that kind of going back to that emotion versus a reasoning concept, is that, wow, it's great to be able to live so long. It's great to be able to hop on an airplane and travel halfway around the world and see something totally new. I mean, this is what evolution is all about. And I think when people look at it from that way, they realize that technology is really, really wonderful. It has given us brand new opportunities to do amazing things. But there's no question that at certain moments in time, technology is very overwhelming. And I think that's where we run to this idea where we really weren't designed to do some of the things. And that's why I'm hoping technology will help us deal with that later by having either chip implants or some type of tech or science that makes us feel better about technology in itself.
Hmm. One of the things that really interesting. You know, 7 years as a big part of this journey, and it's such an odd contrast to go from somebody who has spent that much time in nature to being a transhumanist. And I'm wondering, what in the world, how you would arrive at such a conclusion after spending that much time, pretty much being off the grid, right?
Yes. Yes. So I was off the grid for many years of my life. And I got to be honest, until recently. And when I say off the grid, it's not like off the grid. When you're a journalist, you're not really off the grid that much. And most of, for example, my sail trip, most of my travels, I have been working as a journalist. And so you're constantly thinking of ideas and thinking of where society and culture is going and discovering new stories and reporting back. So as far off the grid as I was, it was never something so much. But, there are so many ideas out there that you get when you have some time to yourself. I've been one of those lucky human beings, for example, on my passage from my sailing passage from Santa Barbara to Hawaii, where I was 20 days entirely alone. In fact, I've done a couple 20-day and a little bit longer passages. So you just get 20 days to yourself to think. I usually read books, but it's quite strange to be in your own head for 20 days at a time and the things you think of to not talk to anyone. So it gives you a lot of time to get to know yourself. And I think that's very important. I wish people in modern society would actually have more of an incentive to travel and to travel alone and to travel without having to worry about, for example, money or where they're staying. This is one of the great things about a boat is you're sort of just stuck. Mm-hmm. And you just get to do whatever you want to do. In my case, I played guitar, I cooked, I read books, and I just thought. I thought a lot. And it gave me a lot of development. And I think that's one of the reasons I've sort of decided to really pursue transhumanism is I kind of worked out logically that, wow, I really love life. I mean, because that's what transhumanism really is about. It's about people that love life, that want to preserve life through science and technology, that want to improve life through science and technology. If you didn't love life, for example, going back to religion, I would say that most religious people are deathists. Deathist is someone who embraces the idea of dying. And of course, a deathist embraces the idea of dying if they're going to have a much better afterlife than this earthly existence, which is supposed to be not very good according to most formal religion like Christianity and Islam. So the idea is these deathists, I guess, want to die, but transhumanists don't want to die. They want something very different. They want to live as long as possible, and they want to live as magnificently as possible using science and technology. And that's one of the things that I think developed over my years of traveling was I really thought about that and realized that at a very core fundamental level in my psyche.
Let me ask you this. What do you think this idea of transhumanism is going to do for both creativity and our capacity as human beings to accomplish and achieve things? And how do we maintain the balance of the things that, you know, we can do? You know, Jeff Colvin just recently wrote a book called Humans Are Underrated. We're going to have him as a guest on the show. And even in the beginning of Dan Pink's book, he says, you know, if a machine can do it for you, you become replaceable. And I'm really interested in how you think the blend of these two things is going to impact our creativity, the things that we can uniquely bring to it, and our capacity as human beings.
Well, to begin with, you know, my own campaign and the Transhumanist Party support a universal basic income. And we support a universal basic income because we're absolutely certain that robots and software are going to take all jobs. My wife is an OBGYN, you know, and her job in 20 years, even as a surgeon with 20 years of training, will be replaced. Uh-huh. There's no question that a robot will be able to deliver babies better than a human being in 20 years. Or maybe it's not 20, maybe it's 30, but there's no question at some point in time that a robot will be able to do the most complicated things that humans can do better than humans. So we're on a timeline that jobs are going to die for human beings. So we need to ask ourselves, where does that leave us? So that's one of the reasons we support a universal basic income, because we want people to feel like they, no matter how many jobs get taken, they at least have the means to survive. But the real question is, what do you do with your life? You know, one of my big campaign platforms is that I believe not only in college education, but I believe we should make college mandatory. And I believe also we should make preschool mandatory, because I feel that a more educated public is going to have more ideas about what they want with their life. It's kind of going back to the sales trip. You know, the more time you have to think and read and learn, the more you discover about yourself and the more you discover what you want to do with your existence. And I think this is very important, because if you just go right into working, whatever job it is, and you don't have much time because, you know, jobs are kind of tough, and then get married and have kids or whatever it is that you do, you don't have much time to smell the roses. It's very important to smell the roses. And I think education for many people is smelling the roses. But the reason I bring up education is because we think as people are living far longer, they're idea of what they want to do with their lives, both professionally and creatively, change. And one thing that's really important for me is that we don't let robots become more creative than us. At that stage, we have to stop robots and either merge with robots or not let them become so creative. I have said this before. I do not believe in letting an artificial intelligence come into being on the planet. Uh-huh. I do not want a smarter entity than me on planet Earth. That makes absolutely no sense to have something like that, because if it turns on me and becomes mean or like the Terminator, then right. We've lost a huge thing. But what I completely support and what I endorse is we should work very hard so that when we get to the level of having an artificial intelligence, we can merge with it. We can merge with the robots. We can become the robots. We can become the artificial intelligence ourselves. And then we could have that kind of capacity to become creative and use the creativity that technology will allow us. You know, instead of a trillion neurons, we're going to now have, you know, a Google amount of neurons, you know, something insane. So that's what I am endorsing for how to keep human beings creative. Is let's develop the technology, but let's not let it run wild. Let's develop the technology so that we can use it and we can become that technology. And at that point in time, that's where I think all human beings, if we still call them that, they'll probably be transhumanist beings at that point, of course, will have this ability to tap into using this creativity that comes from being a part of AI or being a part of some type of machine. And then we'll all be able to kind of go down that path together and hopefully keep our creativity and, in fact, have it so much stronger than it's ever been.
Hmm. So, you know, I've always said the gap between creativity and technology is getting narrower and narrower by the day. And I think it's going to be only a matter of time before it's non-existent. I think there will be a day when we can make feature-length films from our iPhones.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I've had some interest in my book regarding movie. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been waiting for is knowing that if I don't get the kind of deal that I want, in 3 or 4 or 5 years, the technology is going to be out there to do a movie in the book, but in such a good way that I won't need this enormous budget, and then I can do it myself. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's wonderful from an artistic point of view, because it's like you can then take your work and translate into all mediums. And the same thing goes with creating video games. Again, we've had interest in video games for my book and stuff like that. And you're going to have capacity to do all these things on your own and to do them really well. And that brings up so many things. And that's, again, why I think even if robots take our jobs, we're going to, as a species, have a lot of free time and a lot of amazing technology to have a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And I think the world coming in 10, 20, 30 years is going to be far better than the world we have now. And that's a great thing, I think.
So let me ask you this. I mean, the idea of a universal basic income, that seems incredibly utopian and almost impossible to achieve. And I you know, it's funny because I've seen documentaries like The Zeitgeist and I'm like, wow, what a crazy idea that we could live in a world like that. I mean, how do we go from a world in which there are people starving, not getting clean water, you know, not having their basic human needs met, to a level where everybody has a universal basic income? I mean, that's such a gargantuan leap from where we're at. I mean, how in the world do we make that kind of a leap?
No, and I couldn't agree with you more. It is a gargantuan leap, and that's why a lot of my ideas, especially with my presidential candidacy, are very radical, because it's not that they're not good ideas. I think everyone agrees that they're pretty good ideas. I just think everyone says, wow. I was interviewed recently with By Quartz, which The Atlantic owns, and you know, the journalist was saying, fascinating, but wow, impossible to accomplish. And I unfortunately said, yeah, it probably is impossible to accomplish, at least in the next 10 years. We're going to have some type of revolution or some type of like demonstrations in the streets with so many people losing their jobs. For example, the trucking industry with, I think, 3.5 million truckers in America. Mm-hmm. You know, they're already talking within 5 years they're going to have automated trucks. And this is virtually guaranteed. So you're going to lose a huge portion of the workers. Same thing. You can see McDonald's already eliminating people and putting in robot counters, and the same thing happening at various stores like Lowe's having robots. And I mean, everywhere you look, every industry, waitresses and waiters in China being replaced, everywhere you look, robots are sort of taking over. There's no question that this is going to happen. So the real question is, where does that leave us? And when enough people realize that they're going to be out of a job and the government says we can't support everyone on welfare or whatever it is, then they're going to change the system, and that's when a universal basic income is going to stick. I've written an article supporting universal basic income, but I didn't write the article because I wanted to support universal basic income. I actually don't. I think I like capitalism. I like people earning their own keep. But it's not for me to say what I want. It's for me to say what I think is going to work for the species, for the overall good of the species, and what will keep us from fighting each other and having a revolution. At some point, and I hate to say this, that the rich are going to have to give up some of their proceeds to make everybody happen, or they're going to see Molotov cocktails on the streets. I mean, that's just a fact. We can't keep going with this society forward and then have robots taking all these jobs. There must be something. And the universal basic income is the one where I think will cause the least amount of pain, and give everyone a sort of a platform where they can at least have a roof over their head, the food they want, some of the things that they want in their lives. And then they can, of course, work on top of that, you know. But at least everyone will have this basic, I'm taken care of, and we can go from there. And again, like I said, I didn't come up with this. I didn't support this idea because it was the idea I wanted. I support this idea because it's the most realistic one to avoid a kind of a dystopic, you know, a dystopia society.
Do you think it's going to take mass hysteria in order for us to actually take this idea more seriously?
Unfortunately, yeah, well, let's begin by saying it usually does. When you look historically speaking, the French Revolution, some of these things, it usually just takes people getting so upset that something happens. I mean, you can see in the news these days with police shooting black individuals. It's people are getting very upset, and eventually you have enough of that happen where all of a sudden you have to redesign the system and say this is unacceptable. And you know, in fact, I've been trying to do this on a lot of my platform. One of the reasons I'm driving, I haven't talked about this yet, but I'm driving a bus across the country. The bus looks like a giant coffin. It's a 40-foot coffin, essentially, is because we're trying to tell people that right now the United States government, with 100% religious politicians, does not see the need for people to live longer. It doesn't have any policy that is actually advocating for longevity, even though the science exists out there. The budget going towards longevity science is a fraction of the science budget, and the science budget is 2% of the nation's GDP. And, for example, the war budget is 20% of the GDP. I mean, the numbers are so absurd when you think about it, that only 2% of our GDP goes to science and technology as a government. Yeah, it's incredibly it makes me very sad. And the point of the story is that we need to change that. We need to tell people, we need to have activism. We might have to have demonstrations, and we might have to bring out the Molotov cocktails. I hate to say it, but that's how the world operates. Until we get people to say, wow, what is in the best interest of society at large? And obviously using science and technology is in the best interest of society to make them live better and longer and healthier, is in the best interest, then we're not going to be getting anywhere. So we have to take very activist measures in order to get our work done. And I think it will probably take something very activist, you know, take a huge a new generation of people out of jobs that will say, finally, yes, let's pass the universal basic income.
Okay, so let me ask you this. This raises a really interesting question for me because, you know, I've said the internet is in many ways like a developing country, right? There's all this opportunity, and for some reason, there are certain people on the internet who end up building these massive audiences, and somehow it's so fragmented. But the question that the idea of a universal basic income brings up for me is, how then do you deal with the level of motivation that we have as human beings and what people contribute to society and to humanity? Like, what happens when you have that? Like, do you think that will be affected in a negative or a positive way?
Yeah, well, that is one of the things I do worry about, because I think what you have right now is you have a portion of the population that really may not be interested in working, may not be interested in doing anything except buying trinkets at Walmart and potentially just even causing trouble in society. I mean, let's be honest, you know, I think 50% of Americans or something like that have less than $10,000 or, you know, in their pocket any given, you know, available to them. So we have these huge discrepancies in society between the rich and the poor. And I'm not saying anyone's right or anyone's wrong. What I'm just trying to say is there are people out there that don't want to do anything, that just want to take. And that's very hard for those that want to work, for people that have to pay taxes and, you know, all these other things. That said, I'm hoping that in the new age, there'll be certain types of either brain implants or certain types of drugs or certain types of motivating factors that will make everyone want to live the best life that they can live. It's very hard, though, to get somebody that wants, you know, that has not worked for 15 years and just has been getting a paycheck, a welfare paycheck, to actually get back in the game. I'm not sure how you get someone that motivated, but maybe there'll be something like a motivator chip, or there'll be something like, you know, I don't know. But I think, you know, we should just let people do what they want. If they don't want to be motivated, then there's no reason to force them. They get their universal basic income. The only thing we ask is they don't commit crime and they don't, you know, they don't cause problems. Mm-hmm. But that said, it'd be great if we could come up with a device, sort of like a good tall cup of Starbucks coffee, that actually gets us more on the ball. You know, I mean, I hate to say it, but we need something that makes people want to be in the game. And I'm not saying I know exactly what the game is about, but I want whatever someone is doing to try to do it their best. And that usually means working really hard. I don't know what the job is. It doesn't matter. But let's get people, everyone motivated to be the best they can be. And I'm hoping technology will give us some hints or some methods or some chips or implants or drugs or whatever it is to get more people involved, because I would hate to see a society of just people who are flakes. That's the, you know, the transhumanist party is the most open, party in the world. There's no discrimination. There's nothing. Every single, you know, we're very pro LGBT. We're very pro everything. But the one thing we don't like are people that just don't want to do anything because they just want to take from the system. I mean, you have to contribute. You have to be a player here. You have to do something. Just do it to the best of your ability, because in the end of the day, this is a system. We are a species trying to become something better. And that's really the kind of most fundamental thing about the human being. So I am always looking for ways to get people more motivated so that they can find the most potential in themselves.
Wow. Okay, so I have one last question, then I want to shift gears a little bit. One of the things that you talked about is education, and it's something that comes up here a lot on the show, especially with the people that we've had. And, you know, there's a lot of conversations. You know, I'm a byproduct of the education system. I jokingly say that I'm a failed byproduct of the education system because it didn't lead to its intended outcome. And I'm just curious if you think education in its current form is working.
Well, I don't, you know, intended outcome is such a funny way.
Yeah.
And I know exactly what you mean. One of the reasons I actually, so, you know, we are one of our main platforms. One of the most unusual platforms is that we are trying to change the laws of the United States of America and say college and preschool are mandatory, just like high school is. When the high school laws, when people, you know, around the country and all the states decided to make people go to high school, because, you know, at some point in the last 100 years, American government has gotten together and say, okay, kids should get a primary education. Then they said, okay, kids should get a secondary education. Then they said, okay, kids should get a high school education. And they said we should mandate it through law. When they did these laws, people's average lifespans, when they made high school mandatory, people's average lifespans were about 65. Well, the average lifespan is around 87 now, and it's going to be 100 very, very soon, within 10 years. And yet, despite us living, you know, 25-35% longer, the amount of education we are legally supposed to get has not changed. You would think, as we have longer lifespans, you know, if we're living to 150, of course college should be mandatory. I mean, what kind of species are we that, you know, we insist on a high school but not on college? The idea is we are a species that wants to educate ourselves to become, going back to motivation, to become the best we can be, mm-hmm. which is why I endorse mandatory college. But college for me is not about a job, and certainly it's not going to be about a job in the future. What college is about, it's about, I hate to say, but it's about drugs. It's about sex. It's about rock and roll. It's about reading Nietzsche in the middle of the night under the, you know, in the library. This is what it's about. It's not about learning more algebra. It's not about, I mean, sure, it is about, you know, getting better at some of the sciences and math and what that. But what it's really about is that you take 4 years out of your life and you dedicate it to just being someone who is free to study, to improve their minds, to improve their beings. That's what college is about. So when you talk about intended, you know, cause with yourself, I think it worked perfectly in your case, because it's, and certainly me and mine, I think it did pretty well too. I studied philosophy with no outlook on what kind of job I would get. I just studied philosophy because I was interested in it. Uh-huh. And I think that's what I would love to do people. And we also support free education. We also would want to, for example, lessen the amount of money we spend on prisons and put all that money into education, because currently America spends 4 times the amount on the prison system than it spends on education, which is a complete travesty. Wow. So we would pay for everyone's college and pay for everyone's preschool if they didn't want to go to a private school. And the point of the story is that this is the kind of society we need, where everyone on the street can talk about the latest happenings, you know, or what the French Revolution meant when we tied into where the 2016 elections are going, or something like that. This is the kind of, you know, intellect I would like to see from the country, where everyone can speak about Heisenberg principle or something like that, and define it philosophically and talk about it and make better decisions. And it's a fact that the more educated people are, the better their lives are, the better chance their families have a chance to stay together, the wealthier they become, and the happier they are. So education has a direct correlation on virtually every important aspect of our lives. I can't support it enough to say that I would really, it's one of the very first things I try to do is say, we must make college mandatory in this country. We must make preschool mandatory. We must endorse a culture where everyone can go to school, and for free and as long as they want, and they have to at least get these upper education. Those last 4 years in undergraduate education are critical too, because it's when you start really understanding the great literature pieces that we may not have understood in high school. Your mind finally starts getting to a point when it's mature enough to understand, you know, Foucault or some of the other kind of great authors out there that you need to understand.
Hmm. All right. Let me ask you this, and then I want to talk a little bit about the entire process of running for president, kind of a day in the life. In this entire path of yours, have there been any sort of like rock bottom, I can't see any hope for the future moments?
You know, unfortunately, what's one of the things that really bothers me is my own community, the transhumanist community, is not necessarily always on board with my ideas. I'm the figure in transhumanism who has probably the most media coverage, because I have national columns and I'm able to publish a lot of articles. For example, I published an article this morning on Gizmodo, you know, one of the largest technology sites, on environmentalism and transhumanism. And so the transhumanist movement was very small until I think a couple of years ago, when it really started catching on in major media. And of course, I've helped contribute to that with my national columns. And it bums me out all the time that there's a lot of resistance from the older transhumanists in the community who have been around 20 or 30 years. They were a very small movement for 30 years. Now all of a sudden transhumanism has become a kind of a worldwide movement with millions of people, and it's growing, it's exploding in size right now. And it bums me out that I think a lot of some of the community doesn't, you know, they wanted this movement to thrive, but all of a sudden when it does, they're not sure that they like it because they can't control it anymore. And the fact is that that's the whole point. Transhumanism is sort of like the environmental movement. 20 years ago, when you look at who started the environmental movement, who got the world to sign up to saying we all should recycle, we all should believe in green technology, we all should take care of the planet. That was not just something that just happened. That was a group of people, John Muir and some of these other people, that actually started it, Greenpeace. When you look at the history of it, there's a very definitive history of how that worldwide movement took over and made, you know, a couple billion people on the planet environmentalists. I think virtually everyone in the developed world would say, oh, to some extent, we support now the planet. It's not a concept that was here 20 years ago. We're trying to do the same thing with transhumanism, and I'm sort of bummed out that there's people in the community that don't necessarily, when it's starting to explode in size, are saying, we're not really sure if this is the proper direction for the movement. Maybe it shouldn't get so big, or maybe it shouldn't be in politics, or maybe one person shouldn't have so much visibility in the media. But, you know, these are how movements start. And so I fight that resistance every day. In fact, just the other day I announced that, you know, my Wikipedia page has been vandalized again and again, you know, and I get death threats on Twitter. I got one 3 or 4 days ago, you know, and these things bum me out. They bum me out because they happen so frequently. But at the same time, it's not going to stop me from doing what I do. In fact, defiance of this nature just makes me more committed.
Mm. So let's shift gears a little bit. And, you know, I want to wrap up with some just questions that I have out of morbid personal curiosity. I mean, what is a day in the life of a presidential candidate like? I mean, you know, I don't imagine you wake up and, you know, drink coffee the way I do and write 1,000 words and say, you know what, I'm going to check into Twitter and Facebook and waste time. Like, what are your days like now? I mean, and how does this affect, you know, the life that you have? And you mentioned family earlier and the kind of commitments that it takes. I'm just really personally curious, like, how does your life change when you're this visible in the public eye?
Yeah, well, I can tell you that it has changed dramatically, and I think one of the biggest difficulties has been having camera crews in my house, especially with my family. One of the unique things about my presidential campaign is that I think the youngest visible candidate, and so I have an infant, and I'm perhaps the first presidential candidate to have an infant in many decades. I'm not sure about that, but certainly everyone's like, wow, you have an infant, and that sort of changes the dynamics. Most presidential candidates, for example, like Obama, had, you know, 5, 7-year-olds or whatever, but an infant's a very different type of animal because it's an infant. It needs constant, you know, care, and it needs a lot of. You don't just send it to school and see it when it gets home. You know, I mean, it's there all the time. So I deal with a lot of things like that. I actually stay home a lot with my kids, with my infant, and you know, nannies come and go, and there's daycare centers. But I'm here a lot, so I deal with that on a personal level. I change diapers. I think additionally, what I deal with on a day-to-day level is I check my email obsessively because, you know, we our platform with the Transhumanist Party is very much a media-based campaign. We're appealing to the younger generation, and so we're in social media all the time. So just like you, I actually on Twitter or Facebook a lot, putting forth ideas, spreading articles. You know, at this point, we're doing a couple original articles a day on us. So we spread them out. We do that, and then I also write a ton. I make it a very point to write a couple articles a week. I try at least to get out two a week if possible. And, my columns for Psychology Today, Huffington Post, Vice Motherboard, and then I also write for Gizmodo and done some other stuff for Wired UK, Daily Mail, Slate. And so I have a platform where I can write a lot of different things. And I do a lot of writing just to get out policy. My article today in Gizmodo was on because I believe climate change is already here and we're sort of doomed to a certain extent. There's no question, in my opinion, that the weather's getting warmer and, you can see it happening, that we're going to have some significant shifts on the planet. And one way to do that, instead of to recycle more, because I don't think we can stop this shift. You can't get the developed world to stop wanting to be developing world to stop wanting to be developed. You can't tell a nation that's hungry to have cars that they shouldn't drive. So the best idea, in my opinion, is to become transhuman, is to actually work towards the technologies that are going to allow us to survive in environments that we might not have clean air or clean water. And, the quicker we make it to the robotic age, the better we'll be. That's very controversial. I was excited that Gizmodo published this piece for me. But it is actually a mandate that's saying that, since we can't stop climate change, we've already blown it. We weren't very good stewards of the planet. The next best thing we can do is make sure we can survive whatever comes our way. And this is good for a nuclear war or an asteroid hitting us anyways, that we would be able to be merged with machines to survive these things. So I write a lot of these articles. And then, of course, I'm working on my bus tour constantly. That's really the biggest thing I'm doing right now, where we're trying to get this bus ready and take a trip across the country. We're going to deliver a cyborg bill of rights to the U.S. Congress that's supposed to get people more interested in putting policy towards longevity science. Like I said, there's no policy in the United States Constitution or government right now that's actually designed to make human beings live longer. And we think that's a travesty. We want to change that. We want there to be some type of law that states people have a right to live as long as possible, given where science is taking us. And we'd like the American government and Congress to pass such a thing.
Awesome. Wow. Well, Zoltan, this has been really fascinating. I knew it would be a fascinating story to tell on the show. So I want to wrap with my final question, which is how we close all our interviews with the unmistakable creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
What a great question. I think the thing that makes somebody unmistakable is when they have an original piece of them that that anyone has not seen before. Something that is so like, wow, it just takes you aback, and I think that's what makes somebody unmistakable, is when you see them and you know, wow, that's their platform, that's their policy, that's what they're doing. And that's why it's so strange or weird. And you might hate it, you might love it, but whatever it is, it's something that sort of is almost shocking in its originality.
Awesome. Well, like I said, this has been mind-blowingly cool and fascinating, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights and everything you're up to with our listeners.
Hey, I thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been wonderful to speak with you.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.